The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivaled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, along with a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Each week we choose some of our favourite pieces from the magazine and ask their writers to read them aloud. I'm Patrick Gibbons, and on this week's podcast, Paul Wood wonders if Donald Trump would really bomb Iran. In her final week as The Spectator's political editor, Katie Balls discusses NHS reform, Blairism and Game of Thrones with Wes Streeting as she interviews the health secretary with our editor, Michael Gove. As meat consumption in Britain hits its lowest level since records began, Olivia Potts says that lamb is for life, not just for Easter. The explorer Benedict Allen reviews two books on exploration to Earth's extremities, Erling Kagg's The North Pole, The History of an Obsession, and Neil Shubin's Ends of the Earth, Journeys to the Polar Regions in Search of Life, the Cosmos, and Our Future. And he says that both are dancing with death. In his Guest Life column, Cosmo Landisman reflects on the impact turning 70 has had on his sex life, and he says he's still holding out hope for one last fling. And finally, in his Wildlife column, Aidan Hartley takes us through many of the anthropomorphic animals he has seen during his time in Africa. Up first, Paul Wood.
A satellite picture shows six American B-2 stealth bombers parked on the runway at Diego Garcia. The planes, each with a distinctive flying wing shape like a bat, are sinister, otherworldly, and seem like a portent. Surely that's the idea. Donald Trump has warned the Iranian leadership there will be bombing the likes of which they have never seen if they don't agree to limit their nuclear program. The US is also sending a second aircraft carrier to the Middle East and anti-ballistic missile batteries to Israel. This is Trump's coercive diplomacy. And so far, it's working. President Trump wrote a private letter to the Iranians last month demanding talks. Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, Iran's supreme leader, replied publicly that Tehran would not be bullied into negotiations. Threats wouldn't get the Americans anywhere, he said, and if they tried to hurt Iran, they'd get a hard slap. The Iranian president, Masoud Pezeshkian, said they wouldn't negotiate under duress, telling Trump, do whatever the hell you want. Yet last weekend, Iran's foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, was in Oman for talks with Trump's Middle East envoy, Steve Witkoff. The Iranians cavilled about whether the discussions would be face-to-face or indirect. For much of the 2.5 hours, Oman's foreign minister shuttled back and forth with messages between the two sides, who were in separate rooms. At the end, Araghchi chatted for a reported 45 minutes with Witkoff. These were still talks about talks to agree a framework for substantive negotiations, but Araghchi was able to say that no inappropriate language was used. Witkoff can be direct, and another meeting is due to be held on Saturday, possibly in Rome. The Iranians insist their nuclear program is peaceful and they don't intend to make a weapon. Araghchi also says they don't want talks that drag on forever. But it's in their interests to get the Americans bogged down in process. Barack Obama's nuclear deal took 2 years to negotiate. So according to Axios, President Trump used his private letter to give Iran a 2-month deadline for reaching agreement. He added publicly that he would wait just a couple of weeks before hitting Iran with more economic sanctions, secondary tariffs, which affect buyers of a country's goods. As for military action, Trump said after the Oman talks, we'll be making a decision very quickly. But would Trump really bomb Iran? A retired US Air Force General, Blaine Holt, told Newsmax that the deployment to Diego Garcia was a message. Do you see our sword? The B-2s each carry 20 tons of bombs. Khamenei can match Trump for bombast, but he knows there's little his country's weakened air defences could do to stop them. The B-2s each carry 20 tons of bombs. Khamenei can match Trump for bombast, but he knows there's little his country's weakened air defences could do to stop them. Equally, bombing from the air wouldn't prevent Iran from making a nuclear weapon if they really wanted to. The International Atomic Energy Agency says Iran has already enriched enough uranium to make at least 6 bombs. The final steps could be completed deep underground. For the time being, then, the B-2s are leverage. And from his early days building condos, Trump's always used leverage to close the deal. It's how he managed to buy Mar-a-Lago. When the sellers wouldn't accept his first offer, he bought the beach between it and the sea and threatened a housing development that would ruin the mansion's view. He told a biographer, "That drove everybody nuts. They couldn't sell the big house because I owned the beach, so the price kept going down and down." A military campaign that could set the Middle East ablaze is a bit different from ruining some nice Florida beachfront. Trump was famously told by his father Fred to be a killer. As commander-in-chief of the world's most lethal military, he can follow that instruction on a vast scale. But for all the crude threats, Trump is not a warmonger. Several times in his first presidency, he resisted the Iran war hawks, such as his national security adviser John Bolton, who it said never met a war he didn't like. Back then, Trump listened to Tucker Carlson of Fox News, who shared his isolationist instincts. Now Carlson is using his podcast to warn Trump that attacking Iran could cost thousands of American lives. A bombing campaign against Iran, he said, will set off a war, and it will be America's war. There are almost certainly cautious voices inside the White House too. During the election campaign, the now Vice President J.D. Vance said, "Our interest very much is in not going to war with Iran." If MAGA stands for anything in foreign policy, it's staying out of overseas military adventures. Sometimes, however, Trump says exactly what he's going to do. He told Fox News, "There are two ways Iran can be handled, militarily, or you make a deal." If Iran calls Trump's bluff, he could feel compelled to act to preserve his credibility. Issuing wild public threats and being unpredictable is how he does business. Nixon called it the madman theory of statecraft. If the madman is shown to be weak, or worse, rational, it could undermine his whole approach to negotiating. Trump's enemies might choose to tough it out. And on tariffs, Greenland, Canada, North Korea, and China, he could find himself losing, not winning. Bombing Iran might seem preferable. Consistent with the madman theory, Trump shows every sign of simply making things up as he goes along. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was sitting next to Trump in the Oval Office and seemed blindsided when he announced imminent talks between the US and Iran. This was after Trump had said Israel would lead any military action against Iran, and then added a few moments later, "Nobody leads us. We do what we want to do." What if there's really no strategy? Do Trump and his advisers know what they're doing? In the most skillful hands, brinksmanship with Iran would be incredibly risky. But this, after all, is the gang that added a hostile journalist to their text messaging group and sent him their secret war plans.
That was Paul Wood. Next, Katie Balls.
A copy of the leading article from The Spectator is stuck to the wall of Wes Streeting's office in the Department of Health. Is Wes Streeting the Hamlet of the health service? We asked in October, warning against the perils of inaction. We were so riled by it, we stuck it there to hold ourselves to account, Streeting explains. We're going further than your prescription, though. We thought it was insufficiently radical. The health secretary has certainly been busy.
Over the past few months, he has unveiled a range of reforms, including abolishing NHS England. His Blairite zeal annoys some in Labour. He languishes in 21st place in Labour List Cabinet League table of party members' favourites. The party's grassroots won't be reassured by the new admirers won over by his bureaucracy bashing. "Lots of my conservative predecessors and special advisers said we really should have done this," he tells us. On the day we visit his office, Streeting is celebrating. "You have arrived on an auspicious day," he declares, because the latest figures show that NHS waiting lists have now fallen 6 months in a row, that we promised to deliver 2 million more appointments in the first year of a Labour government, a milestone we hit 7 months early. This progress, however, is still far slower than the Independent Institute for Fiscal Studies forecast says is necessary, and Streeting knows there is much more to do. "I feel confident about the direction of travel we're on, but not complacent," he says. We knew that we had a big mountain to climb when we came into government. We've left base camp behind, but there is still a long, long way to go. His goal is to reform a health service that his own advisor, Paul Corrigan, has warned could collapse because of an ageing and sicker population. Does Streeting agree? A tidal wave of doom, as Paul Corrigan might say, and I always listen to what Paul says. Corrigan is an advisor at large, one of the lineup of veterans from the Tony Blair years, including former Health Secretary Alan Milburn. They are shaping an agenda which gives NHS professionals greater autonomy while also holding them to account. Streeting downplays the roles of the Blair old guard to an extent. Corrigan regularly just strolls into the office, offloads some wisdom waves and then leaves again, he says. But he is animated by the idea of an NHS which is more responsive and entrepreneurial. We have actually on our doorstep in Pimlico teams of community health workers who are going door to door in areas of high levels of deprivation and high need and proactively identifying people whose needs are not being met. He says, the interventions are reducing A&E admissions by about 7% in that case, which is not inconsiderable when you've got some of the local A&Es filled to bursting. That's bottom-up initiative. It's one of the things that's driving my conviction that at the heart of Labour's reform agenda for the NHS has got to be the biggest devolution of power in the history of the NHS. We've got to get away from the idea that a system this large, this complex, this diverse can be commanded and controlled by one person sat in this office in Whitehall, or indeed the chief executive of the NHS or the permanent secretary for the department. There is a contrast between Streeting's desire to devolve and the approach at the Department for Education, where his colleague Bridget Phillipson wants to restrict frontline autonomy, even to the extent of dictating school uniform policies. What I care about is ends, not means, he says. Another Blairite echo. I want to give people the freedom to design and deliver their services, and I'll hold them to account on the ends, the outcomes. The other big plank of my reform agenda, and where I'd argue we're going to a more radical place than even your exhortation in your editorial in The Spectator, is on patient power and making sure that people from working class backgrounds like mine have the same choice and the same control, the same freedom to choose the healthcare as someone from the wealthiest background. This vision of individual control of state provision is in the tradition of Blair Gorey's such as Julian the Grand, but Streeting is careful to stress his respect for all of Labour's wings. He cites Andy Burnham as a helpful voice. The great thing about Andy is that he's at the other end of the telescope now. He's been in this role. He's led nationally, but in terms of the devolution agenda and where we want to go, he's doing some really interesting things in Greater Manchester. What does he make of Burnham's less helpful interventions? The Greater Manchester Mayor has often been critical of Keir Starmer's government, most recently attacking the Chancellor's welfare cuts, declaring, "If I was in Parliament now, I would be saying, I'm not happy, you need to change this." Streeting pauses before he replies. I have lots of respect for Andy, and I think we need critical friends, but he's a friend more than he's critical, and that's a general message I've taken. Despite Labour's bumpy start in government, Streeting is optimistic about Starmer's premiership. Starmer is, Streeting says, consistently underestimated as leader. I was definitely one of those people when he won the leadership who breathed a huge sigh of relief that the Labour Party had chosen the path of sanity and electability. But I didn't think Keir was going to lead us to victory in one term, poor sod, I thought. He's going to be the Neil Kinnock, isn't he? Keir always says, I need to be Kinnock, Smith and Blair all in one, and he's done that. Streeting had a trickier time than many of his colleagues on Labour's victory night last year. He only narrowly held on to his seat of Ilford North against a pro-Gaza independent. His majority is now a mere 528. He says the campaign was not all fair. There were two things. One was a pretty ugly propaganda campaign. There was one WhatsApp voice message that was circulating purporting to be me using the most foul language about dead Palestinian children, and that definitely had a big impact on the final weeks of the campaign, he recalls. I fear for future elections if that's a world we're in, where people aren't debating our actual views or opinions or behaviour, but instead are trying to discern what's real and what isn't. So that was disconcerting. The pro-Gaza party also wiped out Labour's vote in a recent council by-election near his constituency. What does his party need to do? The government is doing the right thing. The Prime Minister is showing the right leadership and what you can't. He pauses. It's very difficult in this age of social media. You are bombarded with, frankly, the sort of graphic images that the 10 o'clock news would normally protect you from even after the watershed because it is so horrific. Just the other day I saw a video of a corpse of a beheaded child being loaded into the back of an ambulance. When you are seeing those things constantly on your social media feed, of course you are horrified by it. It is the really brutal, ugly consequence of war, and yet I feel powerless as a cabinet minister. So I can understand why there are lots of people in my constituency and elsewhere who are seeing those images and doing the only thing they can do, aside from donating to humanitarian causes, which is to express their views at the ballot box. I might have been on the rough end of that, but I can't really complain. Could he be tempted to move to a safer seat? Definitely not. Ilford North is my home, and I don't believe in cutting and running. I'm in it to win it. I won against the odds in 2015, I won despite the pressures in 2024, and I plan to go into the next election in Ilford North with a track record of turning around the NHS, making a real change for my constituency, and changing people's lives, and I'll be standing on my record at the next election. Starmer is not a religious man, but his health secretary is a Christian. Or in his own words, I'm as soggy liberal Anglican as you can get. Streeting found God in his youth, even though neither of his parents were particularly religious. I loved the church. I had a real connection to my faith growing up to the extent that I was given. He says, I wasn't baptised as a baby, but we were given the option year 5 or year 6 at primary school of being baptised and confirmed, and I wanted to do it. I had to argue with my parents for permission. However, he ran into problems when it came to reconciling his sexuality with the church. I was in the school choir, I used to read in church, and then I got to my mid-teens and I started to struggle with that. I started to struggle with what I felt was a conflict between my faith and my sexuality, he says. I spent years trying to not be gay as a result. It's only in recent years that I have really reconciled those two things and felt comfortable in my own skin. There are a number of reasons for that. Conversations with our previous Archbishop of Canterbury, with my local priest, the church I now go to more regularly, and a brilliant book by Michael Corran called The Rebel Christ. The brilliant thing about the book is it not only reconciles my faith and sexuality and my faith and my social liberalism, it also speaks to the thing that I think Christianity is fundamentally about, which is social justice, not walking by on the other side, standing up for the poor and the dispossessed, trying to bring about a fair, more equal, more just society. Those are some of the mobilising tenets of our faith. Corran's book argues that Christians should be there for the rejected and detested, with the poor, the hungry, the jobless, the homeless, the abused, the exploited, the suffering. It is a powerful manifesto for radical compassion and indicates an anchor of belief in social justice, which not every Labour politician can claim. Streeting's no Puritan, though. When we ask what else he is reading, he starts scrolling on his iPad. I've nearly finished Tony Blair's book on leadership, although actually, if I was as Blairite as the stereotype suggests, then I should have really finished it already and read it twice by now. Sorry about that, Tony. On the fiction side, I'm in the middle of Fire and Blood, which is the George R.R. Martin history of the House Targaryen. Does he identify as a particular character? Cammy Badenoch previously told The Spectator she connected with Daenerys, mother of dragons, the dictator. You see, I love Daenerys Targaryen, and I don't feel the same about Cammy. I'd love to be in House Targaryen. I'm not posh enough to be a Lannister. In Game of Thrones, Daenerys unites old enemies, fights for the underdog, tames forces others could not, and commands fierce loyalty from old warriors who want both ideas and steel. But in the end, the ultimate prize goes to another. In the fire and blood of Westminster politics, Streeting stands out as a happy warrior. Whether he will wear the crown depends on what victories he can secure for his followers.
That was Katie Balls. Now, Olivia Potts.
Roast lamb is as expected on the Easter table as turkey is at Christmas. But as a nation, we're falling out of love with lamb. Meat consumption in Britain is at its lowest level since records began. And according to the Agriculture and Horticulture Development Board, AHDB, lamb has been in particular decline for the past 20 years. There are a number of reasons for this. Some people are trying to eat less meat for environmental or ethical reasons, while others don't enjoy the richer taste of lamb compared with other meats. Perhaps most importantly, after a long period of rising in price more drastically than other meats, lamb's cost reached record highs last year. It is significantly cheaper to feed a family with a whole chicken or a joint of pork than with the equivalent cut of lamb. Charlotte Mitchell, who runs Charlotte's Butchery in Newcastle-upon-Tyne, explains that lamb makes people anxious. Customers are scared of cooking it, she tells me, and many complain about the way it smells while cooking. And she believes that, as its price has risen, supermarkets have stopped using it as a loss leader, so it appears even more expensive than other meats. The truth is, we have been underpaying for meat for too long, she says. Before Brexit, farmers received money for having lambs on their fields, keeping the countryside clean and tidy. Post-Brexit, however, subsidies have evaporated, which means that sheep rearing is a much more intentional and expensive choice for farmers. The practice of eating lamb at Easter is partly inherited from the Jewish festival of Passover. When God sent the plagues to Egypt, he instructed the Israelites to sacrifice a lamb for each household and eat it that night, and to mark the doors of their homes with lamb's blood so that the angel of death would pass over them. Early Christians adopted the tradition of roasting lamb for their religious festival, commemorating the sacrifice of the Lamb of God. However, Easter lamb isn't actually seasonal in Britain. Quite the opposite. Here, our traditionally reared lamb isn't ready until autumn. During spring, lambs gambol on wobbly legs and follow their mothers. But it takes 6 months to feed those lambs to the point where they are big enough for market. So while we may feel that we are supporting the sheep farming industry by serving a roasted shoulder or leg of lamb on Easter Sunday, the truth is a little more complicated. A ewe's fertility is naturally activated by the shortening of the days, and a spring birth is nature's way of ensuring the lambs get grass at its freshest, sweetest, and most nutritious. Lambs are fattened up in the fields in spring and slaughtered towards the end of summer. So really, the best time to eat grass-fed British lamb is from autumn onwards. It's possible to rear lambs out of season, but those that have been fattened up for sale for Easter have inevitably been raised indoors, where antibiotics, expensive grain, and feed concentrate are far more common. While it feels counterintuitive, it doesn't make sense to rear lamb in Britain to be eaten in early spring. Much of the lamb that we eat at this time of year is actually imported from New Zealand, where lambs born in their spring, our autumn, are ready to eat at Easter. Of course, lamb that comes from the other side of the world has a significant carbon footprint. If we're looking for either a sustainable food choice or to support British farming traditions, Easter lamb is not the answer. There is hope for British lamb, however, and it comes from the demand for halal meat. The AHDB reports that, although Muslims make up only 6% of our country's population, they purchase 30% of the lamb sold. Some 80% of halal customers consume lamb weekly, compared with only 6% of the overall population. Sheep farmers are now being advised by the AHDB to focus on halal customers' needs. We could all be a little braver about cooking lamb. We could also consider paying more for it and eating it more regularly, but ideally in the correct season. But are we really prepared to sacrifice having a lamb on the table at Easter? I suspect not.
That was Olivia Potts. Next, Benedict Allen.
I'm not altogether a fan of what the writer Sarah Wheeler has called the Big Willy School of Expeditions. To me, I once intoned loftily, exploration is not about conquering nature or planting flags or going where no one's gone before in order to make a mark. Rather, the opposite. It's more about a spirit of inquiry, I went on. If anything, the place should make its mark on you. How then do we want our explorers to be? The sort with steely eyes and frosted brow who silently trudges their way poleward despite the odds, though it's never quite clear anymore what they're usefully discovering? Or would we rather have the boffin, a respectable specialist, say, in puffer jacket, who genuinely advances humanity's knowledge while overwintering in a prefab cabin, but frankly risks being a bit, well, dull? Erling Kage is the former sort, known for being the first person to bag not only the South and North Pole, but Everest too. There's no questioning his stamina and intent. Neil Shubin, who we learn is the Robert R. Bensley Professor of Orgasmal Biology and Anatomy at the University of Chicago, is the latter. Neither is a slouch. Take Shubin. In careful, unimpassioned prose, he presents an overview of those at the ice face, as it were, of polar research. There's the breakup of the Larsen B ice shelf, as documented by NASA's Terra satellite. Then there's Willy Dansgaard, the Danish physicist whose diligent analysis of ice cores revealed to us the alarming rise through the centuries of our planet's temperatures. Next along, a Japanese team questing for meteorites. Others tracking the prints of bulky dinosaurs. Still others investigating the use by various organisms of antifreeze compounds. We hear of worms that get through hard times by transforming into brittle strands of sugary glass, reanimating maybe decades later when temperatures are more favourable. And, should you want more, there are 20 pages of dense notes and references. All to the good, then. Fascinating. Important, too. Yet, out there in the stark, cold ends of our planet, as portrayed by the good professor, there's something missing. Drama, is it? Or ego? Folly, certainly. Kage, by contrast, is absorbing from the start. We are a crazy, messed up species, That much is known already. But where better to display our workings, the best and worst of us, than on a wide-open, icy stage where the sun at times emits no warmth? You might not think that the continual questing by a few obsessive individuals for a northerly point on the drifting pack ice would make for good reading. We should surely be tiring now of these blinkered and largely irrelevant polar athletes. Yet it seems there's nothing better than a fairly pointless journey into the middle of nowhere to tell us about ourselves. Out there, our heroes and anti-heroes are stripped down to essentials, like King Lear exposed on the heath. The quest for knowledge turns inward and becomes a quest for self-knowledge and human improvement. Success lies in being a better tactician, a finer operator in the face of adversity, as he, and nearly always it is a he, achieves ever greater levels of diligence, preparation, and also, you fondly hope, humility. Of course, when it comes to striding through uniform whiteness, it is the inner psychological journey, or at least our protagonist's colourful antics, that must deliver. Tales of polar trekkers become character-driven. It helps that the art of dicing with death is quite intriguing in itself, as are great feats of self-delusion. And here they are, a tally of stubborn, maddened strivers, who, from the time of the Vikings, they called the Arctic hinterlands home of the fog, have sallied forth and, to a greater or lesser extent, suffered. If it's not an explorer hacking off his frostbitten toes, the act was hard, but we gather not as hard to bear as the reeking smell of gangrene that had preceded it, then it's the great Fridtjof Nansen and his protege Roald Amundsen, haunted by a perpetual fear of failure. The ice floes become a telling backdrop to national rivalry, false pride and hubris, deftly illustrated by the Italian aviator Umberto Nobile's second, 1928, endeavour with an airship, much trumpeted by the fascist Mussolini. It crashed onto the ice, lost its gondola, and the now buoyant superstructure rapidly ascended, along with six crew members, never to be seen again. Looming large in a crowded field of egotists is the ghastly Admiral Peary, a foremost claimant to the North Pole, who also claimed quite a few Inuit ladies en route. Over the course of 4 years in the vicinity of one perceived rival, the Arctic navigator Otto Sverdrup, the American felt unable to take off his mittens to shake the Norwegian's hand. Helpfully, all these boreal goings-on are interlaced with Kage's own hard-won experience. When it is between minus 40 degrees and minus 50 degrees centigrade outside the tent, it is all too tempting to stay in your sleeping bag for just another 10 minutes, rather than crawl out shivering and freeze like hell. That has been, and remains, the greatest challenge since polar exploration began. And so to the present day, when our greatest pioneers are the sort brought to us by Shubin. From here, the path of wonder and adventure, as Kage puts it, leads elsewhere, past the North Pole to the moon, and on into space. These books of very different persuasions each have their merits. They also share a schoolboy era, dubbing the august Royal Geographical Society the Royal Geographic Society. In Kage's case, it may be the fault of the translator. But you get the feeling that it is he, the one schooled not by academic rigour but the polar blizzard, who is the explorer who'll be the most niggled to have this pointed out.
That was Benedict Allen, and now Cosmo Landesman.
When I turned 70 last September, I had a panic attack. I was certain that my sex and romantic life was over. I'd finally crossed over from middle-aged into old age and had joined that sad tribe of the unshaggable. My life as a fun-loving Lothario was over. Goodbye, hot wild monkey sex. Hello, hot cocoa. Concerned female friends told me I was guilty, once again, of premature self-pity. They assured me that there was sex, and plenty of it, after 70. And just as smokers and boozers love to tell the story of the aunt or uncle who smoked and drank all the time and still lived to 100, so friends told me the story of some aunt or uncle who was still having affairs at 85. I understand their motives. They wanted to give me hope. But I can't help feeling that these tales are just urban legends. I've never met one of these 100-year-old booze and fag guzzlers, or one of these old geezers still getting their leg over. These days, thanks to my chronic arthritis of the knee, I can't raise my leg, much less get it over. I know some readers, especially younger ones, might find this whole topic rather yucky. But if the polls are to believe, Gen Z aren't too keen on sex. The subject of sex in older people, and I mean those in their 70s and beyond, is shrouded in silence. Why? Because society is disgusted at the very idea of old people having sex. Of course, old people and sex is fine when it's all about cuddles and emotional connections and hugs and tenderness. Just look at the old couples featured in surveys on sex and the old. They're always clean and smiling septuagenarians with shiny eyes and shiny dentures, and you think, ah, how sweet. But when it comes to the dark, dirty stuff of erotic life, that's a bong too far. I get it. Who wants to think of their kind, good-hearted granddad in a gimp mask with a sweet granny in her dominatrix kit wielding her whip? No one. Frankly, the thought of me having sex is off-putting, even to me. When my 70th birthday arrived, all my friends kept telling me that age is just a number. Well, I've been 70 for 7 months, and I can tell you that 70 is just a number. Unfortunately, it's the wrong number, at least as far as women are concerned. I could be enjoying a fun bit of flirtation with a woman, but when she discovers that I'm 70, everything changes. I can see in her eyes that tiny flicker of attraction disappear. All flirtation ceases immediately. Her body language, once so playful and inviting, now says, "No chance, Granddad." Fair enough. But the curious thing is that if I had lied and said I was 69, there would have been no problem. But 70, it sounds seriously old. To make matters worse, I often read articles about how women adore older men. Recently, there was a piece in the Times with the headline, "What Women Want, a Hot Older Guy." And there were pictures of Mark Carney, Jason Isaacs in The White Lotus, George Clooney, Idris Elba, and Barack Obama. There are plenty of men out there for whom such articles are verbal Viagra. All is not lost, they reason. 70 is the new 60, 50, or 40. Take your pick. But on closer examination, none of these so-called sexy older guys is actually 70. The only one over 70 is Charles Dance, 78, who is always described in these pictures as one hell of a flirt. It's true that older men are hot, but only when you're an older man with fame, power, success, or money. When I tell female friends I have none of these, they reply, "But you've still got your own hair and teeth." "Yeah, but who cares? Hello, beautiful. Fancy a drink? I've got my own hair and teeth." In my 60s, I could pass as a silver fox, but now women, especially younger women, regard me like a kind, sweet, sexless gay uncle. I'm a shoulder to cry on, a pair of ears to confess to. They ask my advice about their outfits and displays of cleavage. Too little? Too much? They cuddle me, they caress me, they sit on my lap and place chaste kisses on my face. Certainly could not be one squeak of sexuality still alive in this ancient frame of mine. The worst part is, I've started to play up to the role of everyone's favorite gay uncle. "You go, girl," I say with a little swish of my head. I know my time is up. I had a good innings, and I want to give up gracefully. But I confess, I haven't given up the dream of one last romantic fling before the curtain falls.
That was Cosmo Landisman, and finally, Aidan Hartley.
When I was 8, I used to go fishing in the Indian Ocean beyond Vasco da Gama's pillar with Muhammad. Once we pulled out a fish with a domed forehead and a sail fin, a felucci. In Spanish, it's known as the Dorado, referring to its iridescent golden flanks. As we watched the fish suffocate in the tropical air, its pigment, sheathed with a patina of stippled green, was transfigured for a brief instant, like a beam of sunshine on a church mosaic. Then the Dorado's brilliance faded, and by the time Muhammad picked up his knife and sliced open her belly, removed the guts and tossed the body to the bottom of the canoe, it had turned to tarnished lead. As a boy, my hunter's remorse was as strong as my urge to kill. Once we trapped a mole rat, and entranced by the perfection of its fur, I kept it in my coat pocket until my mother found it stinking days later. My bedroom was filled with stuff like a dead mud skipper or a smelly cowrie, a sea urchin, a fox's brush in meths, a bottled dung beetle, or a snake's sloughed skin. In these unfortunate creatures, I suppose I hoped to apprehend the very thing that I saw fade away, what Larkin calls the million-petaled flower of life. Since then, I've enjoyed my share of bloodlust, hunting animals, shooting countless birds, and landing many fish. I recoil at the memory of slaughtering sand grouse, those magical creatures that wheel out of the desert to fill their fluffed feathers with water to fly back to their waiting chicks. When I see a flock of vulturine guinea fowl, I'll still raise a phantom shotgun to my shoulder and whisper, boom, boom. But these days, I'm disarmed by their cobalt feathers and rufous napes. Recently, while working in South Sudan, I spent most of a morning watching a pair of eastern grey plantain eaters flopping around in the branches of a neem tree, calling, in the words of my bird book, with loud, querulous and nasal notes which build up into a maniacal laughter. What a wonderful skill to capture the sound of a bird's song in words. The joy of those plantain eaters convinced me to sign up for a residential birding course with a renowned Kenyan ornithologist starting next month. Richard Meinertz-Hagen, ornithologist, stealer of bird specimens and expert on parasitic avian lice, said that the best way to identify a creature was to shoot it. "Out shooting again, Mr. Meinertz-Hagen," said an annoying lady at him at a dinner party in Nairobi. "Bang, bang, bang." "No," Meinertz-Hagen said, "just bang." But I've lost my wish to kill. Before, I always told myself I was too busy to learn my birds properly, which seems a pity given that around 350 species supposedly live around my Laikipia plateau home. Once, during a battle in Mogadishu, I saw a hoopoe with its crest raised and strutting about as Cobra gunships laid down heavy fire and militias scattered. "I have come to know things about which you know nothing," the hoopoe tells wise Solomon, bringing news of Queen Sheba. But I turned my eyes away and back to the noisy world. In Rwanda, when I raised my gaze from the piles of stinking corpses, I used to catch glimpses of magnificent turacos. If only I had sat down to learn that the turaco is nature's only true blue and green bird, its feathers containing a pigment called turacovidin, since all other birds only seem blue because of the way the light refracts in their feathers, a phenomenon similar to the way that the sky seems blue. Had I known that turacos and some owls fluoresce bright red under ultraviolet light, visible to birds but not to us humans, what riches I might have acquired in Central Africa's killing fields instead of nightmares. Just on the farm, we have ostriches that run twice as fast as Usain Bolt, parrots which can live longer than humans, the largest bird that can fly, a Cory bustard, and hornbills that imprison their broody mates in tree holes until their eggs hatch. We have secretary birds which trample snakes with their thick-soled feet before swallowing them whole, widow birds with tails like Amy Winehouse's hair, which leap vertically out of the long grass to impress their mates, and vultures that will absolutely circle over you hungrily if you lie down for a nap on the plains. Naturally, all these bird species are interesting partly because their personalities can be compared to certain types of human. I look forward to describing how marabou storks and invasive crows are like some particularly unpleasant characters I know, while scintillating sunbirds and fluffy goslings remind me of the people that I like and love.
And that's everything for this week. As ever, if you've enjoyed this podcast, we'd really appreciate a rate or a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'm Patrick Gibbons, wishing you a very happy Easter, and I hope you join us again next week.